Welcome to Sports Mad Rez's This Week in Review podcast, where we highlight the recent news in sports medicine research. This past week, we had two posts on sportsmedrez.org. That's res.org. The first post discussed a systematic review that found that a serum biomarker measured on the day of an injury could help diagnose a traumatic brain injury and differentiate mild injuries from more severe injuries. The second post reported on a study that found that college students with chronic ankle instability have lower activity levels and more symptoms than healthy students. Activity levels appear to be related to the amount of ankle laxity. Here to discuss this week's post is Dr. Stephen Thomas from Temple University, who's the co-founder of sportsmedrez.org. Welcome, Steve.
How's everybody doing?
So, Steve, I thought we would start with Jane McDevitt's post related to serum biomarkers. And she noted in her post that biomarkers may help us diagnose and give a prognosis after traumatic brain injury. But I kind of feel like we've heard this story before. We've seen several posts that have discussed the idea that biomarkers are going to help us in the clinical setting. But what do you think it's going to take to have one of these biomarkers actually wind up in one of our sports medicine clinics?
I think it probably comes down to feasibility and the equipment needed to kind of run these analyses. So to have it, in an athletic training room, or even, a physician's office, they need to be capable, easily kind of implementing and running these tests. So whether it's a small kit that, they could start selling and purchasing, just like drug testing is, you could go to any pharmacy and get a drug testing kit. I think you would need something along those lines, at least in a doctor's office, that it's quick, it's easy, it's inexpensive. For the most part, to really be able to run these. I think the other problem you might run into, though, if it gets too easily accessible, then, people could just go to the local CVS and grab one and take it and try to make their own diagnosis, which, I think this needs to stay within the medical field and have a doctor being able to kind of read these and diagnose them still. But I think that's kind of the limiting factor right now.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'll be curious to see if the new biomarkers that eventually make it to the clinic are more like the way we test insulin, where you can do it on site, or if it ends up being more like the traditional labs that we see patients get in a doctor's office, where we do the blood sample in the clinic, but then we send it out to a company to get assayed.
Right. So, yeah, it's going to be a little tricky, but in terms of how it gets, implemented, I think at first it's probably what you said at the end is, have it, the blood gets drawn and then sent to a facility to get analyzed. But I think we need more research to back up this data and make it very concrete so that one, we get insurance companies to pay for the assessment. And then also, we need to have more definitive evidence to hone in on one or two markers, that we know are definitely related to, the severity or the level of brain injury. Without that information, I think it's kind of like, it's a bit of a stretch and we're, there's not enough proof to really determine, if it's a definite link.
Yeah, I think this will be an area for us to watch for the next 5 years to see what happens. In our second post this week, Nicole Cantano concluded the post by suggesting that we need to educate our patients with chronic ankle instability about how they can maintain a healthy lifestyle. And I know from my point of view and from the talks that I've gone to, I think we've heard this conversation before for patients after their knee injury. And we probably even need to be talking to patients about this type of stuff after other injuries. I was wondering from your point of view, as someone who does upper extremity research, do you feel like we're doing enough to talk to our patients about maintaining a healthy joint after a shoulder or elbow injury? And what do you think we should be talking to them about?
Well, the upper extremity, I think, is a little bit different in the sense of if they do have instability or feelings of giving away, that they could kind of work around it. You know, they typically will modify their lifestyle around it, but they could still maintain a certain level of physical activity with their lower extremity. So in terms of running or exercising with just your lower extremity, most, you know, cardiovascular exercises are lower extremity driven. So I think they could still maintain good physical health in that sense, but they'll kind of work around the pain or the instability in their shoulder, or they'll use their other arm to do a lot of those, you know, overhead or overreaching motions. So that's obviously not an ideal situation. You want them to, you know, maintain a normal physical level of activity with both upper extremities, but I think that's how currently most patients, you know, will kind of work around it. So the lower extremity is a little bit different compared to the upper, I think, in that sense.
Do you feel that there's a good amount of data or not enough data about what's happening to our young athletes who get a rotator cuff tear or an anterior dislocation regarding where they're going to be 10 or 20 years later in life?
Yeah, there's not a lot of, you know, great data in that regard. It's kind of been suggested that, you know, rotator cuff tears will eventually progress to arthritis. And we do see that, you know, that these patients that are getting reverse, total shoulders are typically patients with massive cuff tears and degenerative arthritis. And, you know, you would assume that the arthritis came from those cuff tears, but you could also, you know, it's the kind of the chicken or the egg. Did the arthritis cause the cuff tear, or did the cuff tear cause the arthritis? But there's not a whole lot of data to, you know, definitively show that the cuff tears are definitely progressing, you know, to the arthritic joint. And, you know, in regards to the reverse total shoulder, you know, they do fairly well, but that's a serious operation, there is a lot of complications built into it. You know, the quality of the bone on the glenoid. So basically, for those that don't know what a reverse shoulder is, you're turning the glenoid cavity into a sphere. So you're creating the glenoid side into what the humeral head would be, the sphere, and then you're turning the humeral head into the concave aspect of the joint. So you're switching the joint completely around. So that gives you a more mechanical advantage of your deltoid. So when you have massive cuff tear and arthritis, that's typically the option to get, because it'll give you a better mechanical advantage to your deltoid, which will give you better shoulder function. So that's the thought process around it, but the bony stock of, you know, attaching that glenoid sphere to the glenoid, you're talking about minimal amount of bone as it is there, and then where you position it, the angle, you know, it's very surgeon dependent on how successful these things are. So there's a lot of factors worked into it. And if you don't need a reverse, then, you know, you should probably stay away from it. John Kelly is an orthopedic surgeon at University of Pennsylvania. He's, you know, he's a big advocate of trying to preserve the joint and fix some of these massive cuff tears, at least a partial repair. So say the subscap and the infra, just to maintain stability of the joint, that anterior posterior quarter bounce, so that they could still get good function of their shoulder without a reverse. So he's, you know, he, once you go to a reverse, there's no kind of turning back. That's what you got. So, his idea is to try to at least maintain, good function for a while, and then they could always go to the reverse after that. So, yeah, it's something to think about.
Yeah, definitely interesting. And the shoulder replacement approaches these days are really interesting. And it'll be interesting to see, as you said, how we can preserve shoulder function and delay the need for a shoulder replacement.
Well, right.
Well, thanks, Steve. As always, it's great chatting with you. And to our listeners, don't forget that we also share extra material on social media. And if you're an athletic trainer who's looking for evidence-based practice CEUs, then please check out our 3 online courses available through Human Kinetics website. Remember, you can always follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, or LinkedIn. We'll be back next week with more sports medicine research. Until then, have a fun one.